This is Moss Amper. I'm continuing my interview with Marcella Goldberg, Executive Director of the Pittsburgh Blind Association. Go ahead.
The only way that we could finance my college education at that time was because I had a City of Pittsburgh Honors Scholarship out of high school into Carnegie Tech specifically. And then I had to keep a certain grade average to keep that scholarship through the 4 years. As I think I told you, I was very young. I had no idea what I wanted to do. And so in order to get a liberal arts education, I registered a different course at Carnegie Mellon every year. I think if I had it to do over, I probably would have gone into social work at that time because they had a good school of social work there.
But why would you regret a liberal arts education? You mentioned that you're sorry you didn't go right into social work.
I don't regret it from the standpoint of the information I got. Probably my regret lies in the fact that I was not well trained for what I started out to do, and I had to go to night school to get my master's in social work. So that I was equipped to do the job I was trying to do.
So then you're talking about time, the period of time.
Yes.
But I would imagine that a liberal arts education, the broad background, would really make you a better social worker.
Well, I think it makes anybody a better individual, a better human being.
You have more friends, of course.
But, yeah. I did queer things, you know, for what I decided to do with my life. 1 year I was registered in a home economics course until I discovered I couldn't draw a design. Another period of time I was registered in what they called an English minor course, which is a secretarial course, until I decided this was not for me. It was skipping around, but with it all getting a broad background, which is helpful.
And certainly, home economics would enter into some of the work of the Pittsburgh Blind Association, I would think.
Yes, not in what I'm particularly doing, but in what I'm directing, supervising. But it was different type of training than it is today.
Of course.
And the other thing I think I really used out of my library work was cataloging large type books.
Well, that would be
which was something, that's right. But none of it was wasted.
No.
I wouldn't for a minute. Mm-hmm. I'm very grateful for the education I had. But you asked me if I would do it over, would I do anything else?
Mm-hmm. And you're saying it?
And I'm saying no.
Well, you're fortunate that you made an early choice, and it's been satisfying to you and fulfilling, I would think.
I think the fact that I've been with it so long and that I'm still enthusiastic about it and still challenged by it, proves this.
Yes. I was thinking of something I had read, a quotation, an interview with a middle-aged dentist who said, who hated dentistry, and who said, how could that 21-year-old kid decide what I should do with my life?
Mm-hmm.
So you've been fortunate.
Yes.
Found your niche, and it's been very good for you, and also for the people that you serve.
Well, I hope so.
I've been glancing over a list of questions that I was using as a base, the Legal Council list of questions. I think we've pretty much covered everything that's on that list. Perhaps you have some things we haven't covered that you might want to talk about.
I can't think of anything. I think it really probed all the way around. It's I would probably say that either you are or you are not the kind of person who is geared to helping others, that has fascinated me with the kind of thing that I'm doing. And satisfactions come in very small doses. And one has to be able to accept the small doses to make up for the heartaches that are in the job. This is true, I think, of almost anything in life, but particularly true when you are trying to help people who, to my way of thinking, have the most devastating of the sensory handicaps. I keep saying I don't know how I would behave if I suddenly lost my vision. I know all the ways of adaptation, all the potentials, all the things that are required, all the achievements that are possible, but I'm not quite sure how I would react as a human being.
From what you've told me, and as I listen to you talk, I seem to know how you would react. And over and over, I hear directly and indirectly that you cope and that you have inner strength, that you have managed, and I'm sure you would continue to manage.
Well, I don't think any of us know, really. I know for certain that I would have tremendous fear in crossing the street without any vision. I keep telling the people whom I see travel, and young people, that if I were in this position, I would not attempt to travel without a guide dog. Well, this horrifies some of my blind friends who get around beautifully with a cane. And they say to me, oh, sure you can, you know, or you could. But I'm not as certain. Of course, they challenge me all the time, you know. Our blind girls do such beautiful handwork, crocheting, knitting, this kind of thing. They'll make something, and I'll say, oh, how, if I buy the yarn and I will pay you to make it, will you make this for me? And they say, oh, Mrs. G, you could make it. I'll show you an Afghan. Was a pattern that I thought I would never achieve, and I did it because they challenged me. You know, we can do it, you can do it.
That's interesting.
And but this is their strength too, as well as my responding to the challenge they hand me. But I still don't know how I would react. I don't think anybody does. This is really a devastating handicap. We are dependent upon our vision for so much. And yet there are adaptations that these people make. And I'm full of admiration for them. Even though I prod and probe, you know, and I push and I say, you can do it, you can do it. When they do it, I'm the most startled person in the world.
But although you're saying this, I have a feeling that you're really not the most startled person in the world, that you have these expectations and this is how you're able to help people live up to the potential within them.
Yes, to a certain extent this is true, but they have their own adaptations. Mm-hmm. I can say to them, you know, you can do this if you do it this way, and they'll do it just a little bit different and accomplish it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes all you have to do is give them a cue, and then they work their own adaptations out. And it's awfully hard to get across in a descriptive form this way, but it's so essential for people when they are deprived of vision to train and utilize other senses. And it's remarkable.
Yes,
let's face it. And be honest about it. It's like starting out with the parents of a blind baby, and all they see is the end result, you know, is this child of mine going to grow up and be able to be educated and be able to get married and be able to live a normal life.
Mm-hmm.
And you curse, in a cursory fashion, you say, sure. But we start back here and start this kind of training that will enable them to get there. At this I can do. I don't know how I would do it if I had a child of my own to do this with. I don't think any of us can do this.
I guess that's true. Tell me again, how you are known when you walk into the Skillcraft workroom.
Oh, I walk like a two-ton horse, you know. I always tell them I really hammer my heels as I come across the floor. And they know me by my walk, but they know me so closely by walk that sometimes they're aware of the fact that I'm not feeling well because I'm dragging my heels. Mm. And they will say to me, "Hi, Mrs. G, don't you feel well today?" And I'll say, "Why?" "Well, you just aren't walking with your usual step." I walk through that building and I say hi all the time. You know, if I passed you in a corridor 10 times a day, I wouldn't speak to you every time, but I also wouldn't pass you with a poker face. There would be some sign of recognition, whether it's a lifted eyebrow, a smile, a wave of the hand, something. Mm-hmm. To them, you have to speak every time. So I walk along and I say hi, and all I have to do is walk and say hi, and you saw the young boy who greeted us this morning.
Right.
He stopped when he heard people coming toward him. And I said, "Hi, Frank." And he said, "Good morning, Mrs. Goldberg." You know, just like that, that fast. And they know I sometimes think they know me by my smell. They'll say, "Oh, I like your perfume today," before I even say anything.
But I was referring to something else. When we walked into the Skillcraft workroom, mm-hmm. you said to me, "Listen, and you'll hear 25 go around the room."
Mm-hmm.
Would you talk about that?
Well, this is a code that the boys in this very noisy broom shop have, so that somebody with vision lets all of them know that I'm coming onto the floor. And this means that they watch their language. You know, they're human beings, they're men, they're up in a workshop, they may cuss a little, they may do this or that, and they don't want to be caught with their respect down.
Mm-hmm.
We had an interesting episode not so long ago. One of our blind men was singing at a dinner that we had. He can't sing, but he loves to. And he was singing a song. One of the boys yelled out, "Why don't you sing the ditties that you sing up in the broom shop?" And I'm not even sure he knew I was in the room, but into the microphone he said, "I can't, Goldberg will kill me." So they like to know who's there. Anybody would. You wouldn't, you don't sneak up on anybody.
Yes.
and listen to a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And this would happen if they didn't know that there was somebody.
So then you're known as 25, and you said they at one time it said man in the roof. This was the code.
Yeah, I used to go through the shipping room to a little garage in the back, and we had some blind boys who worked in the shipping room. And for a long time, I didn't know what it meant. I'd walk into the shipping room to go out the back door to get the car, and I'd hear man on a roof. And finally, I discovered that it meant that I was coming through the shipping room. So there are ways in which the partially seeing and the sighted people who work with blind people identify things for them that they would not otherwise know. And I think this is a kindness, really.
Yes.
Just as if you meet a blind person, you identify yourself. The worst thing in the world is to go up to a blind person and say, "Do you know who this is?"
Oh, no, who would do that?
Oh, lots of people. You know, they'll brag, "So-and-so always knows my voice. Watch." And they'll go up and say, "Hi, John, you know who this is?" And if they catch John alert, John may know. And if they don't, if John is not alert, he's embarrassed and they're embarrassed.
It's cruel.
It is. That's right. Well, you know, people do that on the telephone.
Yes. Yes, they do. That's
right. Very often, without thinking. Then they get chagrined, you know, because the person doesn't recognize their voice. Good. That answers back as far as I'm concerned. Because I'm particularly aware of this because you don't do this to blind people.
The people that you have touched, however, know who you are. I know this by
your
devotion to the Pittsburgh Blind Association. And they feel your involvement. I felt it this morning as I was walking through the shop with you.
They come back to me, you know. this is one of the satisfactions that I get out of the job. Children whom I knew as little children and lost track of will call into the agency and want to know if I'm still there, and then come in with problems that are completely different from anything I ever helped them with. I can give you an example that happened not so long ago. A young man called and gave me his name, and I'll bet it has been 15 to 20 years since I saw or heard from him. And he said, "Miss Goldberg, can I come in and see you?" And I knew he was a partially seeing man. I had known him as a partially seeing child. Mm-hmm. I stopped contact with him when he made a good adjustment in high school and he had no need for services at the agency. This was it. Mm-hmm. So I said, yes. So he made an appointment, came in, sat down, and we made some cursory comments about how different he looked, and he decided I looked the same, but he had been a child and I was an adult. And then he said, "You probably wonder why I'm here." And I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Well, I'm having some marital problems. And my family and I have discussed this, and my mother said that the only other time in my life that they had such troubles with me was when they recognized my visual handicap, and you came down and you helped us, and you got me into school, and you helped this way, this way, and this way. And my mother said, this problem is so terrible that you have to find her and she'll help you again." Well, what was the problem? He had been married. His wife married him knowing he was visually handicapped. He had a good job, made good money. But she suddenly was rebelling against his visual handicap, had turned the children against him because he couldn't see certain things, and they had departed and left him lying back.
Oh, my.
And he was really having troubles. And he needed a marriage counselor more than he needed me. And
but he needed you first.
That's right. And I can't tell you, it was at least 15 to 20 years since I had seen anybody in that family or even heard the name. This happens to me all the time.
I would think that it did.
People pop up. And my staff says, "Your caseload has come up to haunt us." Somebody along the line comes back and says that they got help, or somebody they knew got help from the agency, from me at such and such time.
This is another tribute that I know is as meaningful to you as the tangible awards that you've received.
Oh, greater, I think, really.